series, we at the Athens Banner Herald and OnlineAthens.com hope to produce that sort of looks at a myriad of topics, counting down what are the best or worst events, people, places, regarding whatever subject we choose to talk about this week. This particular week, we are discussing movies. With the Oscars being right around the corner, we are going to talk about our top picks for best Oscar-winning movies in history. My name is Donnie Fetter. I'm Director of Content with Athens Banner Herald. And with me today is Andrew Shear, who is our resident film expert.
Yeah, I try to be. Thank you. Thank you.
But anyway, we are, like I said, we looked through the entire history of the Oscars and picked what we thought were our top five favorite films. Not necessarily best, but what were our personal favorite films from that list.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea. Happy to be a part of it.
I guess we want to start from five and work our way to number one.
That sounds good. That's the way I've got my list. Let's go for it.
I'll let you go first.
All right, well, my pick for number five was a movie called The Artist. And the reason why I liked The Artist a lot was not just because it had a dog in it that should have got nominated for an award. If you know your Oscar history, you know that Rin Tin Tin probably would have won Best Actor if they'd let dogs be nominated, because he was the most popular actor of his day when the Oscars began. But what I love about The Artist is, and I know you've got a lot of classics on your list, The Artist was like a classic movie made in modern times. If you remember, it was a silent.
Right.
And it was made in black and white. It was shot in the old Academy ratio, mm-hmm. the square. And the only thing weirder about the fact that it was a new movie made like that was that they gave it Best Picture. I don't think anyone thought that The Artist was going to win Best Picture. Do you remember what kind of an upset that kind of felt like?
Yeah, I remember everyone sort of being fond of the film, but no one thought it was going to come away as the Best Picture of the year.
Yeah, Best Picture maybe, decades and decades and decades ago. But what was it doing there? I mean, what was essentially like a concept film gets Best Picture?
Well, it kind of makes you wonder if maybe the people who were voting on it that particular year were just all a bunch of really old guys
maybe.
Who felt nostalgic for the silent film era.
Yeah, maybe they just because it stood out so much. I don't remember a lot of what the other competition was that year. It's a lot to keep in your head. But to me, yeah, The Artist is just, it's when I was looking at that list of every movie that ever won Best Picture, I forgot that it won. I really forgot because it wasn't a huge successful movie in terms of like box office.
Right.
But it also just, it didn't have the epic scale that we're used to seeing them hand the trophy to.
Mm-hmm.
It was, to me, it's strange, and still strange, that it got the award, but to me, the Artist had to go in there just because of how unique it is among every movie that's
right.
won. Like, definitely, this is a 2011 movie, not so you notice if you watch
mm-hmm.
it.
I do think it's the kind of film that will stand the test of time, though. Sort of in the way Shawshank Redemption has. Did not win Best Oscar that year.
Nope.
It lost to Forrest Gump, I believe.
No way.
But I think, looking back, it's a far more popular film now than Forrest Gump is.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the way history goes, man.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the stuff that gets it where the moment, looking back on it. You had an idea for me to write an article about that. I planned to. Stuff that should have won that didn't.
Right.
That's a whole other subject, definitely.
Yeah, because I know that's one of my favorite films of all time, man.
Really?
It makes me kind of hate Forrest Gump a little bit. For that reason.
We'll get to Gump when we do our worst Oscars.
Right. Yeah, because that's coming next week. Andrew and I are going to re-team to talk about the worst movies to ever win a Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, my number five, I think, is The French Connection.
Oh, yeah.
Love that movie. I'm not going to say it's the best one out there, because it won in a year when Clockwork Orange was nominated, Best Picture Show was nominated. So I don't necessarily think it should have won Best Oscar, but I think it's a great movie with a great performance by Gene Hackman playing Popeye Doyle.
Yeah, man. Well, William Friedkin, he
directed one of your favorite films.
Yeah, he absolutely did. French Connection was around that time where young people in Hollywood were being given the reins, because the executives went, these big budget musicals, people just aren't coming to them anymore.
Right.
TV was stealing a lot of the thunder. And so they're like, whatever you guys think these people will come see, try to do it. And French Connection, keep the history aside, talking about it as an actual movie, the car chase in French Connection was the best ever filmed, I think.
I agree. I know a lot of people talk about Bullet. But First Connection, in my mind, surpasses that in terms of being a great car chase.
Yeah.
Actually, if I read my notes correctly, the producer for the French Connection was also the producer for Bullet.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Because they have a, you know, a similar kind of aesthetic when you're in that, like, being in the car in the chase kind of thing.
Yeah. Only film that comes close in my mind to how good that chasing was would be Ronin.
Yeah, yeah. Ronin gave it a run for its money, definitely. I would do an entire podcast about my favorite car chase movies, honestly. Because, like, I'm a big Vanishing Point fan, a big Tulane Blacktop fan.
Right.
You know,
that's actually really, we'll have to do that sometime next month or so. Do best car chases.
Car chases or car movies, man, there's just such a great list. And the French Connection, in addition to having that, is also just a really cool movie. And Gene Hackman, I don't remember what year he retired, but, you know, he's not acting anymore.
Which is a shame, because he's one of the greats.
He's one of the best. I think, like,
and this was his first Oscar, I believe. He got his first Oscar for this film.
I'm not sure, but I wouldn't doubt him. He definitely did. Popeye Doyle is such a cool character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he's just a symbol of the new movie tough guy that was coming out in that era.
And that's what I loved about his performance, that he didn't play the character like a hero. Mm-hmm. He almost played it much more like a heavy.
Yeah.
which was made it so interesting to see this guy who's the hero of the film acting like a real jerk.
Yeah.
He's much more an anti-hero in a lot of
ways. Yeah, and symbolic of some of the kind of guys we would see in that era, definitely. Because, you know, a guy like Travis Bickle would be considered an anti-hero,
right,
for sure. So, it's a French Connection. You'll see that the 70s were some of my favorites.
I went with another 70s one as well. But anyway, what's your number four?
Oh, okay, so for number four, not to the 70s yet, I picked the movie American Beauty from 1999.
Mm.
And it's another one that I forget when I'm looking at the list that won an award, because American Beauty is super dark.
Mm.
You know, you've got Kevin Spacey in what you could consider his breakout role, and people went, oh, right, this guy is great.
Yeah, I mean, it was his breakout role in terms of leading. I know, because Usual Suspects came out before this.
Yeah,
right? When he got a lot of attention, but this was his first chance to take on a leading role and be really dynamic and stand out more.
Yeah, Usual Suspects 2 is, you know, is more like a genre movie, and even though a lot of people kind of copied it, it was still made in the wake of Pulp Fiction, so
right.
Didn't really get its due, but he was part of a great ensemble in that movie,
mm-hmm.
too. Even though American Beauty, the casting is awesome, because, you know, you've got Annette Bening in there, too, with him playing his wife. But American Beauty was, you know, in 99, it was the eve of the year 2000. There was still a lot of that paranoia of, like, maybe the world's going to end.
Right.
So that year, a lot of crazy risks were being taken mm-hmm. in Hollywood in terms of, because you think about The Matrix now, if someone were to pitch that, people
right.
would be like, and what comic book was this based on? What TV show is this a remake of? They wouldn't do it. They would
right.
never make movies like The Matrix now, and I don't think they'd make American Beauty now either, because they said, they'd say, we don't want to depress people. People are coming to the movies to be, like,
mm-hmm.
kidnapped and have
right.
things done to them. They don't want to see that. American Beauty is just, like, I don't know. It's heavy,
mm-hmm.
and it's dark, and it's reminiscent of some of the films of the more riskier periods of filmmaking. You know, maybe recalling the 70s where people weren't afraid just to go totally dark and have bad things.
Right.
Because I don't want to spoil the movie if you've not seen American Beauty. But it's not necessarily the happiest ending for some of the characters.
It is not. But, you know, also, I thought that movie was really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of very smart humor in it, which makes sense because it was written by Alan Ball.
Yeah, and Alan Ball is great.
He is great. I mean, a lot of people who don't know who he is one of the chief writers and producer for 6 Feet Under, True Blood. So he's made more of a name for himself in television. But this movie was just fantastic. And actually, it was number three on my list, but I'll go ahead and move it to number four.
Sweet.
So we can. I think this is the only movie we share on our list.
Yeah, we had more in common. We found out when we were kind of discussing it, the worst ones rather than the best ones. So that should be fun too.
But American Beauty was just a revelation for me, and I think also, would you agree that this was sort of Chris Cooper's breakout role as a character actor?
Yeah, yeah, I would, because I'm thinking back to some of the stuff I'd seen him in before. He was not. He was given good things to do, but in terms of character actors, it's a lot of times just sort of like a, I don't know, maybe like a generic kind of a part,
mm-hmm.
you know, like interchangeable with other guys that kind of look like
right.
him. He brought something to it that was like, I don't know, Chris Cooper can do this kind of like this stern, cold, but also if you all, it's kind of kind of sympathetic in a way.
Right, you can sort of see in his eyes there's something else going on. And with him, that was on full display with this movie. In a lot of ways, I think Chris Cooper's performance even surpassed Kevin Spacey's.
I'd agree.
And the way he sort of had this reserved rage that was just bubbling underneath the surface.
Yeah,
and suppressed homosexuality.
And that's a hard thing to portray on screen and mm-hmm. still have the audience not just completely hate you as a villain.
Right.
It's hard to get dimension to.
Mm-hmm. You almost kind of felt sorry for him in a way when he was not a good guy in this movie
at
all.
That, it's that face that, like you were saying, it's mm-hmm. that expression that he had that did it.
Yeah. Well, that takes care of both our number fours. Well, what was your number three?
Number three is Midnight Cowboy 1969 for me. This is a sentimental favorite because it was, when I was a kid, my mom always, she hums the Harry Nilsson song for Midnight Cowboy, that mm-hmm. theme, Everybody's Talking. And I always would be like, what song are you always humming? And she's like, oh, this is from Midnight Cowboy. And I'm going, like, you know, my mom was born in 57, so she was kind of a young mom.
Right.
And I was like, well, I would like to see that. She goes, maybe when you're older, you can watch Midnight Cowboy. And so we finally, my mom and I watched that together when I was in, like, early teens.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it, but I don't think I quite got it. But going back, this is a rated X movie. It's a rated X one.
Right, I forgot about that, yeah.
And you've got John Voight and Dustin Hoffman, two of the greatest actors of their generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Voight, if you've never seen Coming Home, that is a really, really great movie. And of course, Hoffman, the list goes on and on.
Right.
But Midnight Cowboy is about, like, a pimp and a male prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And it won Best Picture. And it's not like Pretty Woman at all.
It's not. I mean, these are not likable people,
no. But
you like them anyway. That's a testament to how great actors these guys are.
Yeah, and you know, they're sometimes saying really kind of despicable things, too. If you're familiar with All in the Family, Archie Bunker, there's a little bit of that in the Ratso character. But the thing about Midnight Cowboy that always stays with me is every time I watch it, even though I know how it's going to end, I really want Ratso to make it to Miami. And
right.
I always think at the end he's going to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a testament of how great the movie is, because it has that repeat watchability
mm-hmm.
that I think makes it a classic. And don't let the subject matter throw you off or the reputation of it throw you off either, because the X rating was going through a period of flux at the time. Anything
right.
that was had a overtly sexual kind of material in it,
mm-hmm.
they just flipped out and gave it the rating, even though
right.
and I think if re-rated now, it would definitely get an R.
Possibly even PG-13.
Yeah,
I mean, it really wasn't any sort of anything that really threw me off.
It's a matter of, like I said, I watched it with my mom, and she explained to me the things that
mm-hmm.
she thought I might not know, but
right.
As she found out, the 13-year-old dude knows more than she thought.
And I like what you said about the ending, because in a way, it kind of was reminiscent of Shane.
Yes.
We're at the end of Shane. Is he alive? Is he dead? You just don't know.
Yeah.
In the same way there. You hope he makes it, but it leaves that open-ended question. Okay, we don't know.
And back when movies, not everything had to be tied up neatly and spelled out for you.
Right. It leaves, left a little something imagination. The Graduate is another great example of an ending that sort of had, okay, now they've run away together, and you see that look on their face at the end. Okay, what have we done? What now?
Yeah, guy, you guys never seen The Graduate. Just pause this and go watch. Come back and listen to the rest.
My turn for number three. I chose The Sting.
Yeah.
It was just another great pairing of Paul Newman and Robert Redford. That is, big a fan as I am of those two guys and their previous work together, which The Sting just sort of took the cake for me. I just thought that's one of the best films I've ever seen.
Yeah. When I think about movies like The Sting now, I'm just hearing you say Redford and Newman. Who would tell me two guys now you put together and make a movie like that with them?
Right. I mean, it's hard. I guess probably the closest thing we've come to in recent years would be maybe George Clooney and Brad Pitt in the Ocean's 11 series.
Yeah.
That'd be the absolute closest. But even then, their chemistry together was nowhere near what it was for Newman and Redford. It's a shame they only ever made two films together. Of course, the first one being the Western epic. Now the name escapes my mind for some reason.
It wasn't Jeremiah Johnson. No.
Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Right. I apologize for forgetting that. I don't know why that slipped my mind.
I feel bad too. It's so early in the morning. God, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid is essential stuff.
And George Roy Hill directed both those films, The Sting and Butch Cassidy.
Yeah.
But just, and Robert Shaw also doesn't get the credit he deserves, I think, from his career for being such a great character actor. He was fantastic in The Sting. He probably had his breakout role really late in his career with Jaws.
Yeah, I was going to say, Jaws is probably the thing he's most known for, but they just don't make guys like Robert Shaw anymore. For that matter, they don't make like guys like Newman and Redford anymore either. You know, Robert Redford doesn't do the kind of movies that he used to do.
Right.
You know, he's holding the road, that All Is Lost movie. That was really cool, but you just feel like, man, if only Paul Newman was here to vote this guy.
I know. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember Shaw. I mean, I've only ever seen him do one film where he wasn't the heavy, and it turned out to be one of my favorite war films, being Force 10 from Navarone.
Oh, yeah.
A movie a lot of people have not seen. Harrison Ford's, one of Harrison Ford's early movies. But it was just a really great war movie that no one's ever heard of.
There's so many cool stuff. I hope someone who's listening just does a pen and paper taking notes. Mm-hmm. So many good titles getting thrown out.
Number two
for me, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975. This is the one with Jack Nicholson, the mental institution, playing R.P. McMurphy, one of the best characters ever. You know, he's got a support cast there of all the kind of weirdos. I don't know what you'd call them, but they probably wouldn't have a problem with that. But some of these guys supporting him, Danny DeVito's one of them, Vincent Schiavelli's one of them. Christopher Lloyd, right, is one of them. Brad Dourif is one of them. They had all these great guys. And you know, years ago they made this movie called Girl Interrupted. Remember Girl Interrupted? That's the only other time I can think of when they took people that do crazy really well or look like they might and stuck them all in a bin together with each other. But you also have Louise Fletcher doing Nurse Ratched, right?
It's an iconic character. Oh, it's fantastic, yes.
I love the energy that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest has, because you've got that. You know, Jack Nicholson just plays a crazy guy like nobody else plays a crazy guy, but it's not like Shining crazy.
Right.
He is a real guy, and he's somebody you can relate to being stuck in here. Mm-hmm. But he's got a temper like, oh man, the scene where he wants to watch the game and they won't let him.
Right, yes.
And he just starts to pretend like it's on anyway and gets everybody. Man, if you just watch that clip, you're going to want to watch the whole rest of that movie.
Of a career full of great performances, that I think it was his best.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson was never better than he was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
No, it's true, dude. And when Jack goes, hopefully it's a long time from now, because I would like to see him, you know, bring his career kind of come back, you know, because he's done like Adam Sandler movies. He's done some of not so good James L. Brooks stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But like,
the kind of last good movie he was in that I can recall was probably The Departed.
Departed was so great. That's another Best Picture, right? It would have made a runners up for me, but. When they do that in memoriam thing of Jack, and he'll probably get his own, Cuckoo's Nest is going to be heavily featured in that.
Has he got a lifetime achievement award yet?
I don't know.
Surely he has. It'd be a sin if he has not received a lifetime achievement award.
I don't know. I mean, you know, they gave Roger Corman one not too long ago. He gave Jack his start. I remember seeing a Corman documentary where Jack kind of cries, talking about, you know, about getting his break and everything. And I was like, wow, Jack Nicholson's crying, talking about this B movie maker. So maybe that's on the near horizon before he kicks. You know.
Well, I think this film, in a lot of ways, though, cemented Jack Nicholson as being one of the great actors of his generation.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he had been in some starring roles before that, but nothing that really showcased just how talented he was.
Yeah, I mean, that the dynamics of McMurphy role, I mean, it's something that he didn't actually get to tap into, because, like, you think about an Easy Rider, which someone would say might be the breakout, he was just kind of crazy and he was kind of drunk. He was funny.
Right.
Five Easy Pieces, he got to do kind of a little more of that, but he's next to Karen Black, who's going to take care of all the batty things.
Right.
She was the kind of the crazier one, and he had to kind of be the straight person to a lot in that. So, yeah, I would agree with that, definitely. With Cuckoo's Nest, that would be the. And it's also, unfortunately, why I think his casting in The Shining, as iconic as it is, isn't right for that part. Because as soon as you see him, you're like, that's Jack Nicholson. He's crazy. You don't buy him as a guy who goes crazy.
Right.
Which is the whole story of The Shining. He's crazy from the minute you see him, just from his reputation, I think largely because of this movie.
Which in a lot of ways, that sort of made him the perfect Joker.
Yeah.
I mean, until Heath Ledger came along, Jack Nicholson was the iconic Joker.
He was, and I can remember that being everybody going, like, once you talk about Jack as Joker, there's nobody else.
Right. I don't know if it's true or not, but I had always heard that originally cast for that role was Robin Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Jack Nicholson said, I wanted it, and Tim Burton was like, oh, sorry, Robin, see you later.
Yeah, that was, I don't know, when I did my Robin Williams article after he passed, I think that might have been part of some of the trivia that I mentioned, some of the stuff that he was in line for. But he would have been my pick, actually, for The Shining, because he was in the run for that, too.
That's the way I probably would have gone as a casting director. I would have picked Robin Williams for The Shining. But definitely Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, and when it was remade for television, when Stephen King did like his version of The Shining as a miniseries, they cast Stephen Weber, who was a sitcom actor.
Right, which and it's probably unfair to Stephen Weber. He did a better job, I think, than people give him credit for. But comparing it to Nicholson in The Shining, there's no competition.
Well, it's a Kubrick movie. You're not gonna best Kubrick on television. It won't happen.
No, it was insane to even try. I don't understand why you wouldn't just show The Shining, the original, on TV instead of trying to remake it.
I can't answer that. I don't know. That's all I remember about it was the casting, honestly.
For number two for me, I picked Casablanca, going way, way back. Oddly, so when I was researching this, I read some trivia about Casablanca. I didn't know. But apparently they were writing that film on a day-to-day basis.
Wow. No.
They didn't have a set script when they started filming, and pretty much they were writing it that morning and shooting it that day and into the night.
That's incredible.
That's amazing, especially amazing for what is considered probably the most well-written movie of all time.
Yeah, and back in an era where you planned things to the nines before you were actually shooting, a lot of it was just kind of like, go by the page.
Right, and that blew me away when I read that, because there's so many great lines.
Yeah,
that were just coming off the top of somebody's head that morning over their breakfast. that kills me, and it turned out to be just. And even though it was mostly just shot on sound stages, it just had this sort of epic feel to it. I still can't. I'm not quite sure how they pulled that off.
Yeah, no, it's one of those that we can. When people talk about like the magic of the movies. And if someone wants to wonder, like, well, what is Casablanca and why is this considered a classic and why should I watch classic movies?
Mm-hmm.
It's because they didn't have all the things that they have now to make movies.
Right.
And some could argue that's why they were better.
Right. And I also think it's a testament to Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart, who did not win Oscars for this film, I don't believe. And they were so great, but I don't even think it was their best performance. I think Treasure Sierra Madre was Humphrey Bogart's.
Yes, I agree with that.
I would say Notorious was Ingrid Bergman's.
I agree with that too. Yeah.
Often overlooked in that because they're obviously the big stars, but somebody gets overlooked for how good he was in Casablanca is Claude Rains, I think.
Yeah. Man, I was talking about Claude Rains to somebody not too long ago because, as we'll find out in a few minutes, how big of a horror movie fan I am.
Claude Rains, in a lot of ways, he sort of made that movie.
He did.
I know he was a comic relief, but he was just so spot on. And everything he did with that film, it helped it stand out above a lot of the other contemporaries. Because there were plenty of movies around that time that were about World War II.
Yeah.
And this one just stood out above all of them.
That is going to change the way I see Casablanca, because I did not know that about the movie, how it was put together. I had no idea. Coming into it, knowing its reputation, you just enjoy it as a cool movie, but I have no idea. That changes everything.
Yeah, I can't. Like I said, I could not believe they wrote that like from day to day, just going along as it did. And I think also a testament to Michael Curtiz as director for being able to take a script he's only getting that day and shoot scenes with it and know exactly what to tell his actors to do to get the most out of them.
Yeah, it's a skill that actors or directors rather today might have. Back then, I don't think most of them did.
No.
Because a lot of them were coming from stage or radio where things are, everything's mapped out in advance.
But I think this movie benefited from that Bogart and Bergman were not stage actors. At least I don't think they were.
I don't think so.
A lot of people talk about Laurence Olivier being this great actor. And I don't want to demean him, but he was a stage actor, and in his performances on film, he's still a stage actor.
Oh, no, yeah, and you can see, like, his Hamlet, I don't think is the best Hamlet.
No, I don't. I agree with that. Or is Henry V?
Yeah.
I think in both circumstances, Kenneth Branagh out there.
Yes. So, is Henry V? I think I saw somebody do a, like, some kind of dissertation about this very subject at the Classic Center a couple of years ago. Yeah. Sorry, Olivier. There is an art to be, being a film actor is its own thing.
Right. And Branagh was a stage actor as well, but he knew how to tone it down to be a film actor.
Yep, two different animals.
Anyway, get back to our actual topic. What was your number one?
My number one pick is The Silence of the Lambs from 1991. And as listeners to my podcast, The Cinemaphile, know, I got a soft spot for horror movies. That's just me. I'm not really into a lot of the newer ones, but I really love the old ones, the classics on through, some of the campiest and cheesiest. Silence of the Lambs, my Uncle Bill, he was the one to tell me about this movie. I didn't know, it kind of wasn't on the radar of the fan of Jason and Freddy.
Right.
But he was just like, this movie's coming out, and I know you like scary movies. I'm going to take you to it. But first, I'm going to let you read the books. There was a book before by Thomas Harris, and there was a sequel to, which was Silence of the Lambs. So I read both of these, and they were, like, terrifying. I'd never read anything like that, because there's, like, a lot of true crime influence with this stuff. And I also didn't really know who Anthony Hopkins was. We go see Silence of the Lambs, and at the time, I was like, this is the best movie I've ever seen. I mean, they elevated what would be, you know, the serial killer movie to this, like, crazy heights. And I can actually remember watching Michael Mann's Manhunter, which is an adaptation of Red Dragon, the book that came before.
Which is, I would also point out, is a superior film to the Red Dragon that came out a few years back.
Brett Ratner made that one. But, like, parts of it were shot in a high museum, so that was cool for me, being from Atlanta, seeing that as well. But, yeah, for Silence of the Lambs, man, I mean, it is a movie about Hannibal Lecter's a cannibal. He eats people.
Yes.
And it got an Oscar for a movie about a central character is a cannibal. I mean, think about it. That's crazy. And that's why I put it as number one, because horror movies, my favorite category of film, they never get nominated for Best Picture. It's crazy.
No, they don't. It's a shame, because there have been so many. I know Exorcist is one of your favorite films.
Yes, it is.
We mentioned William Friedkin earlier. He also directed The Exorcist.
Sure did.
And to me, that's a movie that should have been. I think it was a contender, wasn't it? But it didn't win.
No, and it was just. I think at that time, I don't think anybody could. People were quite ready to give a best picture to a movie with somebody possessed by the devil.
Right.
We're talking about, like, horror movie tropes here, and that's why it's amazing to me. But Silence of the Lambs, I think it was just undeniably great. And I think
it
that was
everything point. About it. The production, the pacing is so easy to screw up in those kinds of films, but it was dead on.
Yeah.
The characters, I mean, Ted Levine.
Buffalo Bill.
A lot of people have no idea who Ted Levine is. They probably know Ted Levine more from his role as a monk than they do from his film career.
Yeah.
But he's done some really great job in film. Silence of the Lambs being one of them. Heat being another where he's great in that.
Michael Mann. Yeah, speaking of I still kind of can't get over it. And the thing of when you proposed this and I was going through all the movies that had won, like with The Artist, like with American Beauty, I was going like, I forgot. That's a cool movie, but they gave that Best Picture? Because, you know, most times you have to agree with this, they give the same sorts of movies a lot of times the trophy, and it's often dramas.
Right.
You know, and why not? Drama is a really tough thing to pull off very well. But, you know, horror, you want to scare people. And the scene in Silence of the Lambs where the lights are all off, and you've got the killer's got the night vision goggles on, so Jodie Foster's character cannot see him, but you see what he sees, so you're afraid for her because you know more than she does, and that's one of the ways suspense in film works, either keeping you completely in the dark or letting you know just as much as the character or more. All of it makes you scared. I can remember being super terrified, but I feel like I'm still just talking about a cool, scary movie. I'm talking about the Best Picture winner, you know?
Well, you know, and I think Jodie Foster's performance in that particular scene, more than anything, really set this movie apart. She really conveyed that sense of terror without being a stereotypical scream queen about it.
Yeah, and in those scenes, let me just remind you, I think I may have said it before, this movie won Best Picture. Think about all the films throughout history where they created these elaborate sets, huge, amazing this particular moment of this movie, you've got nothing. You can't see. All you see is Jodie Foster in a, you know, poor quality kind of green haze of night vision goggles. So, again, you know, for something to be that kind of stripped down and be a genre movie, Silence of the Lambs, it will be in horror if you go looking for it. Best picture.
Now, in opposition to that one, my film for best Oscar winner of all, my pick for best Oscar winner of all time, is more far more epic in scale. And it's reaching way, way back to, I think it's only the third film to win best picture, and that being All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
If you've never seen this film, you really need to go win it. It is so fantastic. It's one of the early talking films as well.
Yep.
So don't worry, for those of you who don't like silent movies, this is not one of them.
Nope.
It is black and white. And I don't think anything that epic had been made other than maybe Birth of a Nation
probably.
Prior to it.
Yeah, probably. I mean, All Quiet on the Western Front, for me especially, because I would not consider myself a fan of war movies at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my favorite ones, the ones that I personally think are the best, are the ones that aren't necessarily really about war when you watch it.
Right.
And I think that could be said about that movie.
Yeah, I think this movie, even though it did have like a lot of great battle scenes, epic in scale, this one is more of a character drama.
It is.
In a lot of ways.
It is, that's how I see
with
it.
This young German soldier who is so pumped to go fight for his homeland, then experiencing the horrors of war, and not just the actual battles, but the living conditions, and, you know, having to deal with rats gnawing on you when you're asleep, and that kind of thing. It's just such, but from a production point of view, I read that this was the first film to ever use crane shots.
Is that right?
Yeah, once I read it, I remember the scene they're talking about, a great shot of these soldiers in the German soldiers in the trenches who stand out so much because they have, like, at the time they had these big spikes coming out of the top of their helmets.
Yeah.
In World War I.
Yeah.
And it shows like this line of soldiers in the trenches, because this was also the first war that introduced trench warfare.
Yeah.
And they made a very strong effort to make sure that was included in this film, so people could just see how horrible a way that was to fight a war.
Yeah, and that is a good point, because they are that's not the way war movies were made back then, because they didn't want to necessarily turn people against the idea of war.
Right.
Like, you know, the Vietnam era later would be, you know, when they call it, you know, the war that was on the TV set, and people saw, like, how really bad it was. And a lot of people talk about that was kind of the turning point as far as public opinion about war. But
right.
If you watch All Quiet, this movie is not, I mean, it's not trying to sugarcoat it. It's not trying to create, like, G.I. Joe heroes out of these people.
Yeah, it's clearly anti-war film.
Yeah, and that was against the trend. I should say, if you've got Hulu Plus and you're watching your TV shows on Hulu Plus, All Quiet on the Western Front is part of the Criterion Collection package that's on there. You can just throw that right on.
And I would also, you know, I think, you know, a lot of movies like Platoon owe a big debt to films like All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah, I mean,
Apocalypse Now.
definitely. Maybe even Born on the 4th of July or Johnny Gunn
right.
and stuff like that.
Any film that's come along that sort of tried to show you the reality of what war is, you know, it all goes back to that genesis of All Quiet on the Western Front. That was the first film to come along to really sort of tackle that subject. And they did it so brilliantly.
Yeah, and they didn't bury it. They gave it Best Picture.
Yep. I remember this. Do you remember the part where they kept passing around the boots?
Yes.
You have to watch the film, because there are moments of levity. We don't want to make you feel like this is just one big long.
Oh, no, absolutely not. It's got a great dynamic to it, and that is probably the coolest. That scene for me is really, really cool.
And I don't want to give it away. You just have to watch to see what we mean about them passing down the boots.
Yeah, just know that it's not going to be a soul crusher. It's a great experience.
Right.
All these movies are great picks, and they're not going to be like ruin your day kind of stuff. And I think that's when people, when you're talking about movies about war, they're like, I don't want to feel like that, especially if it's not super heroic about war. But
right.
If you're a fan of film and you're looking for some of the more iconic ones or the game changers, All Quiet on the Western Front is absolutely one of them. And talking about movies like this, you know, not unlike someone that has died, it keeps it alive. And it keeps keeps it part of the conversation.
Right. And I agree. And that's sort of why we want to do this. We want people to go back and revisit some of these great films. And hopefully you will. But we're going to go and shut it off for the day. Please join us next week when Andrea and I are going to reteam to talk about our worst Oscar winning films.
Yeah, it's gonna get, it might get a little ugly, guys.
Yeah, I hope so. Deservedly so. All right, thank you, everyone. Have a good day.